The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. This week I'm speaking with best-selling author Sloane Crosley. Sloane Crosley, you are the New York Times best-selling author of I Was Told There'd Be Cake, which, by the way, has one of the greatest book covers I've ever seen.
Thank you.
I adore the cover. Also, How Did You Get This Number? And The Clasp. Your work has also appeared in GQ, Maxim, Elle, NPR, The New York Times, amongst a litany of other places. It is such an honor and a privilege to have you on The Marrow. Thank you so much for coming, Sloane.
Thank you for having me
here. And you also have a nice list. You also have the names of one of my favorite female characters all time in a movie, Sloane from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Peterson. People sometimes called me Peterson in high school.
Really?
Yeah.
Was there a specific reason your parents chose the name Sloane?
There is, actually. And it's funny. Sometimes people, I mean, you would never do such a thing, but I have met people that ask me if I'm named after the movie. And
oh,
I'm like,
okay.
Thank you. Are you also going to card me for cigarettes?
Yeah, right.
Clearly was born before then.
Yeah, right.
yes, actually, my mother was quite pregnant with me. I think she was like 6 months pregnant, and they hadn't decided on a name. And she was watching a Charlton Heston movie.
Okay. Not
one of the better known ones.
Okay.
called Diamond Head, which is I believe a volcano in Hawaii, but it's about the pineapple industry, I believe, and this biracial relationship that the pineapple heiress is conducting. And the woman who plays the heiress was a French actress named Yvette Mimieu, and yet I did not get named either of those things. But her character's name is Sloane Howland.
Really?
And my mother was just watching TV, and she thought, that's pretty, done.
That's great.
We should never take her to a tattoo parlor. She'll just point to something and get it.
That's a great reason, the anchor and the mom. That's a fantastic reason.
Yeah, so that's my – and they really liked it beyond that. I think there was a little bit more decision-making, but that was definitely the sort of cue ball break of thought towards naming me that.
So do you have a family that kind of growing up absorbed the arts and absorbed stories, whether it be film or literature?
You know, that's a good question. I don't – I would describe them, absorbent would be good, like paper towels.
Yeah, they're the bounty.
Right, but they didn't necessarily produce. Like, I don't come from an artistic family. Having said that, it's in the cement, somewhere of the structure of our family. It's just not prominent. So my father used to work in advertising, and obviously there's a lot of, creativity.
Yeah.
perhaps not always for a good cause, but creativity that goes behind that.
Of course.
And my mother actually is a wonderful artist, but she's been teaching special ed for about 30 years.
Really?
So, yeah, she's a saint. I don't skip a generation.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but she's also a terrific artist. Her paintings are all over my house. So it's in the and my sister is a jewelry designer.
Okay.
It's hard to say. And so between all of that, it's not our the first foot we put forward.
Sure,
but it's in there.
But it sounds like you were certainly in a family where you could see that it was a valuable thing to invest some of your life in.
Yes, definitely. I think but there's such a difference. I remember reading an article. Do you know who Ann Patchett is?
I don't.
She's a wonderful author. She's a book out now called Commonwealth. Everyone buy it. She's great. And she also wrote Bel Canto, which was a really big book. And she owns a bookstore in Nashville. Hmm. She's a good one. But I remember reading either she wrote it or it was an article in the Times Magazine about her mother, her relationship with her mother, whose name is Jean Ray. And Jean Ray is a huge, very popular sort of best-selling author. Mm. And Ann Patchett at that point had written, sort of more literary stories. I can't remember if she'd won the Pen Faulkner yet, but it was just a different level. Mm. But she talks about how wonderful it was growing up with her mother because author was always a very viable and ideal profession.
Yeah, right.
Whereas in my family, it was certainly encouraged. There was none of this what is that silly stuff you're doing when you could be pre-med?
Right.
Was everything you did was very encouraged, which is lovely. Mm. I mean, not in the gross millennial, you can do no wrong way.
Right.
Just in the, we believe in you kind of way. But it wasn't really seen as a profession. But I didn't really see it as a profession until about 6 years ago. I had a full-time job, and then I quit it.
And you were in you were a publicist. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that,
I'm all over the place.
No, I love
long
it.
Answer to your question.
No, it's a perfect one. I could just listen to you talk. But so in that childhood, I'm so curious. Like, what do you remember? The first book that you came across that kind of marked you, and that really resonated with you.
Oh wow. It's so hard to pinpoint.
You can say three. You can say four. You can say seven.
The truth is I probably don't know. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's probably something that I was some sort of like pre-literate ooze, and I read something.
Yeah, right. And subconsciously, you know? It just became a part of your brain.
Right. Like, I'm pretty sure my first movie was The Fox and the Hound. No recollection.
Amazing movie,
but
though.
Amazing. I mean.
See, I remember, though. I mean, you're right. I'm sure I encountered things before the recollections I have. But, like, I remember reading The Lorax.
Mm.
And I remember.
Speak for the trees.
Being so mesmerized. I mean, not only by the words, but the combination of the words and images. And even then, like, you know, if I went along the progression, then a book like Hats for Sale and The Giving Tree. And then there was this collection of books I read when I was in, you know, my adolescent junior high, and I looked like a very, you know, emaciated Harry Potter. And I read this book called Moss Flower that was about these like badgers and toads. It almost had a very Wind in the Willows kind of quality to it. And then if I progress further, when I was 16, and this was so pivotal for me, because like you, I was never, like the arts were celebrated in my home. Mm-hmm. But I never had someone in front of me who I felt like was kind of a banner carrier telling me that it was a viable pursuit with your entire life as a hobby, yes.
Did you have a different – sometimes people – but I didn't even have – it's not like my father wanted me to therefore go into advertising or my mother wanted me to become a teacher.
Right.
Like it wasn't even a path that wasn't writing. Did you have – like were your parents I want you to go into the family business?
No, they weren't like really like they didn't have necessarily like this chronology of my life mapped out, nor were they like all draconian about, well, you've got to be this. Like it wasn't like that. But I think they just wanted me to have something stable. I mean, my dad was an orphan, and he grew up in inner city Chicago, and he was born in 1940 in obviously what was, and in the years following, was just a really difficult time. And even given his economic background, for my dad, vocation, not that he didn't enjoy what he did, and he was in education for, you know, from the time he's in his early 20s until he died. But for my dad, vocation was about survival. Like it was a way to materially survive. It was like the notion that if there's food on your table, that is success.
Right.
And so while they didn't steer me in any way, the idea of pursue writing, you know, didn't necessarily equate to the same survival.
Well, you don't even have to have I mean, it sounds like yours was more pronounced, but you don't even have to have that background for – you know, every parent who's sending their kid to college and paying a fortune for it being like, oh, a philosophy major, great.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, that's really common.
That's right.
But yeah, so they were encouraging, but they were definitely – I always think that my life now is like a bad Onion headline where like nice Jewish girl from Westchester quits job for her basically no health insurance.
Right,
you know,
right.
Okay, that's right. Not happening. So it was a bit of a departure. But it's worked out so far.
And when along the way did writing like start to become something that you were leveraging a lot of your time towards?
I sort of always was. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. You asked before what books made a mark. And I mean, the truth is I know there are early ones. I know there's Shel Silverstein ones that are floating around there. Mm-hmm. There's one really short one of his. I mean, there are so many long ones that everyone has memorized, but I can't even remember. I'm going to mess it up. I shouldn't even bring it up because I don't have it memorized. But I remember I think it's called Baby Bat. Hmm. It's like the baby bat woke with a start and said, like, shut out the light, turn on the dark, or something like that. Something adorable.
Yeah, right.
You know, I don't know. I just remember. Right. I remember it vaguely. maybe I should quote something a little more highbrow than screwing up Shel Silverstein. But like the Once and Future King, I thought was amazing. I remember reading that and just really feeling something that not everyone feels. The thing I think when a dancer or a, you know, 8-year-old girl or, yeah. or a guy goes to see the ballet, and I see that, and I mm-hmm. think that's beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
so happy I saw it. Now I'm going home.
Right.
And then there's a different gene you have that thinks, how do I transport myself into that person's body? I mm-hmm. want to do that thing.
Hmm.
And so I think reading some of those books, you know, A Wrinkle in Time, The Once and Future King, all that
yeah.
stuff, I thought, gosh, I couldn't believe – what if I could – not write The Secret Garden because that's never going to happen, but mm-hmm. just delve into a world like that with
yeah.
writing was just so enchanting to me. I didn't go home after I was done, you know,
yeah, right,
mentally.
Right.
And then I had always written, you know, I was a editor of my literary magazine in high school, things of this nature.
Do you remember the first thing you wrote?
Yes. I do.
Break it down for us.
I wrote it. It's not going to come off well.
Now you really want to know.
The first thing I wrote. So I had a bit of a learning disability as a kid. Not like a horrible one, but enough mm-hmm. that something was going on where things I should yeah. know I didn't know, mm-hmm. which is sort of how you tell a learning disability, where it's actually everything is going fine, mm-hmm. except for you have these spikes of like true idiocy and incompetence. And you think, well, you're an otherwise intelligent person. What's happening?
Yeah, right.
It's not just that you're bad at this one thing. It's that it's like you're temporarily concussed.
Yeah, right.
So my parents, you know, in true suburban fashion, started watching me like hawks, and they were, you know, very concerned, and they were trying to help me constantly, and they would monitor me while I did my homework and check my homework, and I just felt they were sort of breathing down my neck, which, you know, learning disability or no, that's not fun.
Yeah, so
I wrote them a story that was kind of a parable, I guess, about a family of bunnies, and every day they live in the woods for all the woodland bunnies that there are. Every day the parents go out and get carrots and they bring it to the baby bunny, and that's how the baby bunny survives. And then one day the parents go out and get carrots and they get shot, and the baby bunny starves because he doesn't know how to get his own carrots.
I did not see the twist in the bunny story
ending.
In the bunny story
yeah.
coming.
Let's all be grateful it wasn't wow. illustrated.
So how did your parents respond?
They got the picture.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think I was always I was a creative kid. You know, I was mm-hmm. always, you know, putting on little performances, drawing when I was really really little, and I found mm-hmm. out that I remember learning what the word curator meant. Although I mispronounced that because I'm one step ahead, and thinking that I wanted to be the curator of the Met. I was very,
yeah.
You know, yeah, I thought, oh my gosh, you get to arrange the paintings.
Yeah,
that sounds
right.
so great.
Yeah, right.
But it didn't pan out. So, I mean, it still could. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
But I don't think so. and so, yeah. And so I was just always writing short stories. And then when I went to college, I was going to be an anthropology, archaeology major. I was. That's what I was really interested in.
In Connecticut, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I just couldn't push English to the side anymore. It was like, that's really all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it
lingered. I mean, it was always there, whether you were willing to fully embrace it or not.
Yeah, it's like being gay.
Yeah, right. It's always there, whether you're willing to embrace it or not. That's
yeah.
exactly right. I remember when it comes to words, like, I had this English teacher in high school named Catherine Ruck, and she was taking us through, you know, British literature. So we had done every, you know, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and Beowulf.
Aww.
And we got to the Canterbury Tales.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for me at that time, I wasn't necessarily the 15-year-old boy who was going to gravitate towards an ancient British man, you know, that wrote
yeah.
in really like kind of dense, ornate English. And so, but she, the way she taught it, I mean, for me, she was like my Mr. Keating in Dead Poets Society. Like, she made this thing that to me seemed so disparate from my life, and allowed it to, allowed me to see how important it was to me.
Right.
And I started to like feel stories that I didn't even understand. And I remember one of the things she did as we were kind of concluding our study was she assigned everyone in the class one of the characters in the Canterbury Tales.
Were you the wife of Bath?
No, I wasn't. I wanted to be the summoner. although, whatever. There's a lot of demons in that door, but I was the friar. and And we all had to dress up. You're required to dress up. You're required to deliver some excerpt. Mm-hmm. And she took us down, and this was outside Chicago. And there was this kind of like prairie path. It was a bike path, but it was all wooded around, pretty private. I mean, it was about as far removed you could feel from civilization in that suburb. And we walked. I mean, I don't know how long it was, but we walked, and every so many steps or every quarter mile, we'd stop, and one of these people in our little, you know, new made Canterbury Tales would deliver their part. And her doing that, I mean, that's still like...
That's wonderful. It's still She's like a great teacher.
She was, she really was like my Mr. Keating, but that like, that echoed with me. And even though I didn't necessarily engage writing as a viable vocation in my mind then, or even, you know, through college, when I started to, I kind of looked back and saw that that moment was, I don't know, I mean, the heat on that ember was still kind of there.
Right.
I just kind of looked beyond it for way too long. But I mean, I will always be grateful to her, always.
That's wonderful.
Always. But you do some teaching.
I've done some teaching. I'm no, you know, second coming of Mr. Keating. I don't think so.
What have you learned? Because you've taught in the MFA program at Columbia, correct? Mm-hmm. So what have you learned in teaching about writing that you didn't learn previous when you were just writing?
I think I didn't teach. I was a sort of visiting professor.
Okay.
I actually don't remember the term, but I only taught like 6 or 7 classes. I wasn't like a professor there fully.
Okay.
And there are people who are wonderful professors there. Mm-hmm. And it's also MFA level is tricky because those people are basically my age.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and they're
right.
grad students, and right. they know exactly what they want to do. And so the class I taught was narrative nonfiction that was only open to MFA candidates in fiction.
Okay.
So for them, I think it was a little bit like the way the Olympians treat the ice capades, you know? they're like, whatever.
Okay. That's a good analogy.
But, you know, a couple of them, what was really interesting is you know, you give up some of your assumptions about what they'll know. And you just have to deal so much with people's different personalities. Like when I got the list of people who were going to be in the class, they were all prose candidates except for one who was a poetry one. Hmm. And I thought, oh boy, that's going to be that person's going to be a pain. Turns out she was magnificent. Because poets know about economy and grace and scale. Mm-hmm. And they're just, you know, all of it really lends itself to essay for writing in this really surprising way.
Hmm.
And they were all really wonderful. But it was sort of this sharp range. I think what I learned was, but for myself, how much I know that I didn't think I knew, you know. Where, you know, when I was just barking at people and lecturing at them, I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, there's like a little person on the inside of my head that's thinking, are you still talking? and then the second I'd stop and they'd ask me questions, I'd think, oh, gosh, I know the answer to that. Okay, great.
Yeah.
And so we had a really nice exchange. And then some of it I just couldn't some of it was too – I didn't even know how to answer. I mean, one kid asked me, adult asked me, I remember at some point, what the difference was between an essay and a play. Do you know, I mean, so like – at that high level even, it can get so abstract that you're like, I don't know, what's the difference between an essay and an orange?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we're getting,
right.
you know, you have points.
Right.
and then other people had read a tremendous amount of stuff and really were finding their own voices. And I think that's the other thing that was comforting and interesting about teaching is the point is not to make other people write like you.
Mm-hmm.
The point is to make them write like themselves. But that's very difficult.
But you talk about that. I mean, the idea of finding your own voice, and you have such a unique writing voice. I mean, it's so intelligent. It's really lovely. And then it's so blunt and crude in the best way possible and really, really funny. I mean, how have you worked to develop your own voice?
I think I've worked to develop how to train it. You know, like the way you like tie strings around certain plants to make them grow a certain way. So like that's the voice itself is not something that had to be developed except through living. But how it gets them put out in the world, you know, like what comes out the other end of the machine, that's what you have to work on is you know, how do you want it to be? Do you, I mean, how do you make people laugh? What's the point you're trying to make? Why are you even telling this story? And I think with essays, it's very different with fiction and nonfiction, but with essays particularly, I think there's a mistake that people make where they, when they're first writing personal essays, where they're just imitating the surface of what they see in something and something else and not realizing the engine that's sort of behind it. So you get a lot of these confessional essays, which there's nothing wrong with them. There's some wonderful confessional essayists, Nora Ephron being the patron saint of them.
Sure.
But you get these essays that are just like, and then, and then, and then, and, you know, here's my tale of woe, with no real point. And not only do you have to sort of sing for your supper a little bit. This isn't just like a cocktail party conversation.
Yeah, right.
But if you have any ambition to connect with your reader, like there has to be something a little more universal about it in your own story. And people, I've read a lot of essays, I feel like, especially online, that tend to, not that like, I sound like a 90-year-old woman, online, they get
in my
out.
Day, right.
When they've been faxed in. but, you know, or it's just like, where it's meant for, it's like clickbait, basically.
Right.
You know, the worst thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah, right.
But I think that usually there has to be more than that going on to make a really layered, good essay.
Do you feel like arriving at your voice is something that's possible, or do you feel like that's something that's kind of the evolution of a lifetime within the craft?
I think you have to have a, I think maybe the latter, like an evolution of work within the craft. That's better put than I would have put it. I think that because you practice.
Yeah.
I mean, haven't you ever, you don't even have to be a writer for this. Haven't you ever looked at a report you did on the phylums in fourth grade? Like a super cool, like hand-drawn cover, and like maybe like a vellum, you know, plastic thing over it, and you find it, and you remember how great you thought it was when you wrote it. And I know you were a fourth grader, so I'm not trying to be hard on your fourth grade self.
Right.
Not everybody needs to be like Kierkegaard at, you know, age two.
Right.
But I just feel like you have that feeling as a writer too. I have that feeling about essays that I wrote in the first book, even the second book, where I think I cringe and I would have written them slightly differently now.
But
if I just started writing them today, I wouldn't have that cringing feeling and wouldn't know how to make the next thing better.
That's such a fascinating subject to me. Earlier in the season on the Marrow, we had this amazing, just really remarkable model on, and she was talking about her portfolio and kind of revolving around this idea. I suppose I had an agenda behind the question, but I asked, how do you feel when you look back on the origins of your portfolio, thinking that she would express some semblance of shame, or almost like, if I knew what I knew then now or whatever, you know, I could have done that so much better. And I was so I was surprised, and I was kind of, this may be stretching the emotion a bit, but I was a little bit in awe, and I had a lot of envy that she could say, I'm so proud of it. And
right.
I don't, and like you, there's, that happens to me sometimes, but a lot of times my sense of disappointment or the cringe for me comes in recognizing the gap between the way I saw the world then or the way I was able to capture that in words then and how limited I see that now.
Right.
And it's the gap in between who I was and who I am, not only as an artist, but just as a person. That's where I start to cringe. And I guess I feel like I'm looking at old, you know, sophomore year pictures of myself. You go, why did you think that was cool to wear? Why did you design your hair that way? That's kind of the way I feel when I look at some of my old work.
But they're, for me, they're not mutually exclusive. So you have, I have the cringe and the pride usually wrapped up in one. So I am happy. I mean, I wrote that book. I'm happy I wrote those essays. And sometimes, you know, if you're feeling down, you can't believe you had the gall to do it, you know? So that's, it comes up in one. And the other thing is the reason why, I mean, it's especially surprising to hear a model say that, which, you know, I don't know that many of them. But is because they're photographs. Like the example you just gave is looking at an old photograph of like you wearing some doofy outfit.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
Where you're like, this is awesome. Who wants to make out?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
No one.
So just... Yeah, no one. Yeah, I have my Battlestar Galactica
right.
shirt on.
Why? I'm right. beating them off with my lightsaber, yeah. you know? But like the reason, so the reason it's like part and parcel of the thing that we do think is most humiliating, which yeah. is our, you know, our own image. So the idea yeah. of someone being proud not only of the work that they've done in the past, but the work mm-hmm. if it's an image of themselves is actually a little bit surprising. Like, you know, I would think if I was a model, because I think about this all the time, like, a lot, just like twice today already. Like if I think I'm sure there's some like gradations within, you know, their industry or that craft, if we're going to call it that. Where you think, oh gosh, that's I could see like my dead eyes, like I was doing mm-hmm. nothing with my face.
Yep.
I was trying to pretend to be sexy or pretend to be serious mm-hmm. or pretend to be fill in the blank in
right.
this photo. And I'm sure I would have the same feeling I have
yeah.
about the same feeling you have, the same feeling yeah. I have about weirdly my essays. But again, I would be proud that I did it.
Mm.
Even if I just
yeah.
hope no one ever saw it.
Yeah. And I mean no that I mean that gives me a lot to think about and I resonate with that and that I mean, and part of my perception of the work I've done, like the little catalog that it is, I look back and it all depends on my own view of myself prior to looking at it, like in the moment. Like
right.
on Tuesday, I might be able to look back and go, wow, like, wow, that's pretty good, actually.
Right.
But then by Tuesday evening, based on how I feel about myself in the moment, I might be like, it's terrible. I'm terrible. And then the typhoon, you know, down we go, the esteemed toilet bowl or whatever.
But also as you go on, and this should be what happens, you know, your life expands
mm-hmm.
To sort of meet your own expectations and your own goals or
mm-hmm.
what have you. And you start, sometimes I'll think, okay, it's really good that I've done these things. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, then the age thing comes into it where you're like, okay, what have I accomplished by
mm-hmm.
this time period,
yeah.
that kind of stuff. Which is sort of arbitrary and
mm-hmm.
Superficial.
Mm-hmm, right.
But it does, you know, I'm a human being living on the planet, and I think,
yeah.
okay, what have I done? And when I think about it that way, I think, well, that's pretty good.
Mm.
But then once you decide to make any career in the arts your life, that's, you know, it's what you do. It's your job. It's
mm-hmm.
no longer like, oh, that's so neat that you have a book on the side.
Yeah.
Like, no, this is my
right.
rent.
Yeah.
This
right.
is this
yep.
is what I need to do. So
yep.
it's actually no longer cute.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It carries a lot more weight.
And then it becomes more pressure.
Absolutely, it does.
Yeah.
How has living in the strange and diverse ecosystem of New York City, how has that aided your work?
Aided and abetted.
Yeah. Yeah. How has that helped you? Or and then maybe on the other side, how has that been a sticking point?
I mean, well, you certainly, for nonfiction, I always feel like you need to bounce off the world a little bit more.
Mm.
And for fiction, for me at least, and I think that this is true of a lot of writers, you're more like a chipmunk. You know, you need to like store it all up in
yep.
your cheeks and then
mm-hmm.
run to wherever you run and, you know,
right.
have no one around
yep.
while you're digesting.
Mm.
But for nonfiction, you need to bounce off the world. And I tend to do a lot of social observation stuff, etiquette things, the way people interact, comedy
mm-hmm.
of manners things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I write tends to be quite dependent on me watching other people, seeing
yeah.
a diverse group of
mm-hmm.
other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, New York City is the most wonderful and the most ridiculous place to live. You know, it's wonderful, but it's part of what makes it wonderful is because you give yourself, it's like you self-hobble, you know? You're
mm-hmm.
like, I'm going to make my life very difficult in many
yeah.
ways. And yes, sure, it's convenient that you can walk to a Duane Reade. But in more profound ways,
right.
It's a really difficult city to live in,
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
financially, emotionally, the weather,
yeah.
everything. And
yeah.
so you set up all these things for yourself. And then if you can survive them with any humor, I feel like that is always such a pleasant experience.
Yeah, right.
You know, because
right.
it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying no great literature will ever come out of St. John.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
probably not.
But I love that. I mean, part of what you said in there, I mean, it seems like the environment doesn't matter if you're not going to be observant within that environment.
Right.
And
well, then you might as well leave. I mean, I leave
yeah.
town to write sometimes.
But you talk about that idea. I mean, that your your power of observation. Really, for me, it really comes through in your work. I mean, even in the beginning of the clasp, you know, when you're talking about, I think his name is Victor,
mm-hmm.
and he's standing kind of on the fringe of the tent, and you talk about the way the stones leading out to the ocean are changing color in the rain, and then even like how he's concerned about his shoes getting wet.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's such a, I mean, obviously that characterization really for me as a reader already kind of puts me inside the psyche of this person and really inside like, I don't know, a meteorological moment that I've like seen in some way.
It's really raining when that novel opens.
But I mean, have you always approached your environment with that rate of curiosity?
I think so. I mean, because I was the youngest of my whole family, cousins and all.
Big Jewish family?
No, just the youngest. So, like, my sister, I have one sister, but, and, like, I don't know, like, 9 cousins. You know, but that doesn't seem particularly big.
My wife, when we have, a big family gathering, the first time, I come from a family where I have no cousins. It's just me and my 2 sisters.
Okay.
And my wife has 3 younger brothers who are all 3 such dear friends of mine, but then it's like just this infinite galaxy of cousins, and there's so many of them, and they all tend to age into the sibling above them, and because I only see them every couple years, I like lose track of the names, but it's just this massive family. So put it, your 9 is somewhere between me and Kristen.
Yeah, but the point is just that if there was I felt I mean, they didn't like lock me in a closet or anything like that, but I just felt like a little left out, you know, and stuff like that. When you're, I think I had the perfect, maybe a good breeding ground to become a writer, and the fact that, I mean, if we're just talking exclusively about childhood, and the fact that, you know, it's not like I had no friends. So I had people to commiserate with, to observe to hear from, but I did not have, you know, I felt very much on the fringes, which is the best place from which to observe anything. And so you start watching a little bit like that. I lost track though. I was gonna bring up something else, but I forgot.
I feel like that. Sometimes I feel like I'm much more of a. I mean, again, it depends on the moment, but at times I am way more content to be a spectator than a participant.
Right.
And I mean, I am like the proverbial fly on the wall at the party.
Really?
Kind of standing back.
So.
And,
just remembered I was when you talked about the detail with Victor.
Oh yeah.
Sorry,
there was
something I was going to answer your question, and I feel like I didn't answer your question.
I love that.
The difficulty with the novel is, I mean, you were asking about, you know, honing the observational skills or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hate to say, you know, this whole thing, like it comes naturally, because that also makes it sound like I'm not working at it, and yet that part of it isn't really work. It's just how to put it. Like I said before, you know, it's how to then phrase it. The actual observing of something either comes or doesn't.
Yeah,
but with the essays, you know, they're all – I is the most common vowel. Mm-hmm. They're all from the first person.
Yep.
So if I see something, you know, you're drinking a cup of coffee right now, if I you know, notice that, that's fine. I can put it in if it makes sense for the story or the point I'm trying to make because I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty with the novel is just because I spy a joke that would be great in that moment doesn't mean that these characters will. And if you don't control it and you don't give them their own voice, they all start sounding alike.
Yep.
So that was a very interesting process.
Yeah. So with some of your characters, you actually had to make them less of an observer of life or they would all feel like you.
They would all – well, that's a trick question. I just had to make them have different personality tics and flaws than I do. Mm-hmm. And what – you know, you're eventually – by the way, what we're talking about doesn't – are like training wheels. Like eventually they come off. So like eventually these people after, let's say, just to assign a number to it, like, you know, 70, 100 pages, by then they kind of become – you start thinking of them, okay, around 70 or 100 pages, I started thinking, well, that person would not say that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first almost you know, pre-development of a real character and a personality.
Mm-hmm.
And then by, you know, the end of the novel, and then, of course, in subsequent drafts, you go back, you think about what they would say in the positive, and they become quite real.
Yeah, right.
It's a little like Westworld.
I mean, culturally speaking, we're so, in a good way, largely a good way, at least in my opinion, spoiled on just really extraordinary visual storytelling.
Right.
In light of that, how do you feel as someone who one of your primary mediums is, you know, print on paper?
Right.
Like, why do words on paper matter?
Because there is nothing stronger than the human imagination.
Hmm.
No effect is as strong as that.
Hmm.
Nothing is stronger than being in your house alone, feeling like you hear a noise and freaking yourself out. You will never be as scared by a movie
right.
as you will by like a shutter banging in a house that you rented that's like maybe you're alone.
Yep.
You know, and you will never feel that kind of connection. I mean, it's not like movies can't do anything. They're magnificent. You can't – the visual work is done for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really putting yourself in the position of that character.
Yeah.
I mean, you're empathizing with them, hopefully, and that's, I think, the danger of what you're feeling with Westworld, where it's like your empathy is not there yet, which is a hook that you need in order to sustain, you know, a season of watching this thing. Or just to sustain suspense, you care.
Yeah.
You know, is Jon Snow going to come back to life or not? These are large questions. So that meant something. Whereas I feel like with books, you're in it immediately and you can, it's your own, you control the pacing.
Yeah, right.
It's literally meant for you. And it's also done by one person. It's not done by a team of people. Mm-hmm. So you feel that intimacy, I think, much more easily with books than you do with anything else.
That idea, though, that's so much of what I think of when I think of the reading experience and the printed word experience is the intimacy. Not only because when I am the audience to the author, that I have a responsibility in it to fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I feel like really remarkable authors delegate and count on the reader to play an active role, like you said, in the imagination. But the other thing is, even from a very like kinetic standpoint or from a very environmental standpoint, to consume a book, it requires just me and the author. Like, I can't do it in a circle of 100 people. I can't do it in a theater.
And you can't do anything else. You can't read in text. You can't drive and read.
And
you
know, so that word you use, intimacy, to me, it's not only in the sense that there's like a collaboration to the imagination happening. That idea that, you know, when it comes to writing, it should begin in the mind of the writer and end in the mind of the reader.
Mm-hmm.
But even it's intimate in the sense that it's the two of you.
Right.
And there's not other people around, and you do have to kind of focus and harness your psyche and your soul or whatever, even your fingers on this other thing. And I mean, when I think of the value of words, like what that, I mean, Sloan, when I ask myself, when am I most unhappy? Like what's going on in my life? Like I see all these symptoms, what's really going on? While there's a range, oftentimes for me, it's that I'm busy, and I hate being busy, and I become really unhappy. And one of the things that reading does for me is it brings me back to more of this kind of quiet, more of a solitude, not isolation, but solitude. It just reduces the pace of my life.
Right.
And even the, like what you said, like if I'm in a movie theater at a Broadway show or at the ballet, the pace moves on. It kind of drags me along whether I'm keeping up or not.
Right.
The wonder of a book is I feel like through these words, and though the author isn't intentionally doing this, the experience itself lends itself to someone going, hey, we can run at your pace or crawl at your pace, or we can sit down for a week together and that's okay too.
Well, it's also for you. I mean, that's what's weird about it. It's this odd kind of date where like I go into the room, I sit at the table, and like I have the first part of the date and then you have the second part of the date and we never meet. It's like a very bizarre feeling. And I feel like it's strange because part of the price of that for the author, though, I mean, it's wonderful for the reader, but part of the price is it doesn't belong to me anymore.
Yeah, right.
So people will say, you know, like, oh, you know, I thought this character, you know, some people think my characters are assholes.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really love them. Or they see themselves, or they, you know, even the reviews were very funny because I was lucky that they were nice, but but they would say, you know, there's it's a love triangle. There's three different characters, Kezia, which is a strange name, Nathaniel and Victor. And they would say, oh, well, Kezia, like, who's a clear doppelganger for Sloane, or a clear, you know, like, this is her host body or her host monkey. And I think because she's the woman?
Yeah, right.
The weirdo who's, like, sort of depressive and in his apartment who only knows it's raining at 3 o'clock because the mail he picks up is wet, that, that's a little closer to the center than, I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit of me in all of them, but, like, they're, you know, it's just, but then, but this is a decision someone made.
And
what's weird reconciling is that'll be a positive review. And so, like, the part of you that's like, well, you have good taste, sir. wants to be like, maybe they're right. But I'm like, no, they're not right. It's just what they think. It's not mine anymore. So,
And it, I mean, letting go, I mean, it is. It's the relinquishing of the control and going, you're free to, I mean, I love the, what is it, the, I love the line in The Breakfast Club, you know, where he goes, you know, who are we? And he, you know, the kid is writing, played by Michael Anthony Hall, and he goes, you see us as you want to see us.
Right.
And it's like, it is similar where it's like, you see these people as you want to see them. You think they should do things that they're not going to do, and that's maybe going to make you mad. And then for some people, that's going to create some sense of wonderful surprise or, like, tremendous disappointment.
But even that misunderstanding is so funny, because not misunderstanding, but even that, like, sort of friction, I suppose, is a lovely compliment because it means it's like what we were talking about before. It means you care enough to be disappointed.
Yeah, that's right.
When this character doesn't do what you think they should do.
That's right.
When, or you care enough to be elated or surprised by a different character, meaning that you've believed them as a human being enough that you're surprised by their actions. So I feel like that's even that sort of friction. Is okay. I don't mind it if people totally miss the mark or miss the point, because that's what they saw and it belongs to them. They bought the book.
not just somebody. I guess I, and I'm sure you get this too. I've been asked so many times, like, what do you want? Like, what are you hoping for someone to get out of this or this or this? And I basically just completely plagiarized Jack Palance's character in City Slickers, where he goes. You know, where he ends up saying life's about one thing, and he goes, well, what's it about? He goes, well, that's what you got to figure out. Similarly, when someone is exposed to my work, whether that's live poetry or on print or whatever it is, they say, what do you want to get out? And I go, one thing. And they go, what is it? And I go, I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
I just want you to feel something. Like, I just want there to be, like, and I always get, like, emotional talking about this, and it's something I like, for me.
It's like a painter sensibility more
than. But I love it about words. It's just, like, I don't, I don't care, like, I want a word that maybe wasn't as meaningful to me to mean something to you or something, or maybe we feel a congruence in our emotions in one part, but I don't care as long as someone encounters something.
It is amazing. Well, the thing is, what's crazy is that, and this is what's strange about books, is that they are sort of frozen in a way where a photograph you can only – I'm not saying – I mean, they're incredibly powerful photographs that are, you know, worth a lot more than a novel. But it just – they – you're not necessarily going to see something new every single time. You might go back and see something new three or four times. It might change its meaning to you, but not really every single time. But there's, like there's just so much room in a short story or novel or, you know, to have, like you said, a line means something to someone else. You know, you don't look at a photograph and think, well, that tree in the background is now what means the most to me.
Yeah,
no, everyone's looking at the image of, like, the haunted 10-year-old girl up front. You know, I'm just – all I can think of is, like, Sally Mann right now. but I feel like it's funny. I remember writing I wrote a – for my thesis, I wrote a novella in college. And there's a part in the beginning where a girl is in a gas station restroom and she fills up the sink with water and she dunks her head in. There's a part later where there's a lake involved. And then there's a part at the very end where some of the characters are looking out into the ocean. But this is over the course of, you know, I mean, I guess 80 pages is what it would have been. And when my thesis advisor, you know, to give you honors, they have to approve it, and he critiqued my spelling, which was really interesting because he definitely had a typo in his letter. I'm like, all right, that's fine. We'll just let that go. Yeah, exactly. But he said, I especially loved the concentric circles of water imagery and how they get larger throughout the narrative. And I felt like the Marshall McLuhan scene in Annie Hall, where like he just shows up and he's like, you don't understand my work at all. And I was like, good, you know, go with God. That's right. What you love.
Yeah, right. More power to you.
That's what appeals to you.
More power to you.
Great. I mean, do I get honors at the end of this and I get to graduate and get the heck out of here?
Right.
But, you know, it was one of my first sort of real lessons, because it's also the longest thing I'd ever written to that at that point, about how much it doesn't belong to you.
Yeah, right.
That it's a gift to somebody else.
Yeah, right.
But it's like perfume. It smells different on everyone who wears it, you know, which is a little bit different than most other art forms.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, and that's such an interesting – I mean, that's somewhat life in general, right?
Right.
I mean, it's like we see people and – I mean, again, you see them filtered through however many years, days, and seconds.
Or the Breakfast Club thing you were saying.
Yeah, you just go, you see what you see.
And people do that. I mean, I've had relationships that are like that. And this is what's amazing, is it all sort of, the art imitates life and vice versa thing, where, you know, you're sort of trained to do that by books and movies. And I guess I'm part of the machine. I'm sorry for your bad relationships, anyone who's listening. You know, the part of the machine that's like set up unreasonable expectations.
Yeah, right.
Or the part of you that's not even – doesn't set up unreasonable expectations for a person, but just sort of forces all of us to become little amateur screenwriters of our own lives and think, okay, well, this person's going to say this and I'm going to do this. And then obviously you're the kind of person that's going to do this. So I either want to be with you or don't want to be with you.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's so hard. Right. And I hate to sound like a dirty hippie, but, you know, just to live in the moment a little bit.
Yeah.
And think, am I enjoying this? Great.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens tomorrow.
And let that be enough.
Right, which is really hard. It's hard for me personally to turn off, and probably maybe I don't know if it's hard for you as well, but if you create things and you have to have maybe not a whole grand plan, but like you're constantly looking around the corner. You know, what is this going to turn out to be?
Right.
It's hard to shut that off in your personal life.
I mean, amen, Sister Sloan, you know, like 100%. But that leads me to a question because I mean, You're such a strong writer, but you know that idea of seeing what's around every corner. So when you're beginning a project, particularly a long-term project, and I think The Clasp was about a little more than 4 years. I mean, that's a
thank you for reading. Yes.
Yeah, you are so welcome. I mean, but that's a remarkable investment of time and dedication. But when you are just beginning, and it's you and your, you know, ancient typewriter, keyboard, or papyrus, or wherever you create. How much of the skeleton do you have in mind? Do you have a more organic process, or do you really work to kind of get up all the 2x4s before you even proceed?
People are very different with this. The thing is, so I was used to writing essays, which one of their main best qualities they have is that they end all the time.
Yeah.
They just keep ending.
So you
sort of take a thought to fruition, you take a story to fruition, and you tie it up in a, you know, a neat or a sloppy bow, and you're like, that's the, okay, next ball up, here we go, we're moving on. Whereas you just have to keep on opening that door, the same door every day, and building with a novel. So my first instinct was to approach it just almost as an essayist, but I couldn't sustain it, because then you get not very far. It's almost like being in a labyrinth. Well, she's not going to get very far. Don't worry. We put like an ankle bracelet on her. about 30 pages in before you think, where am I going? Mm-hmm. And then you need some sort of structure. Otherwise, you end up with like a 6-page description of an oak tree that nobody wants to hear but you. you have a certain, I love P.G. Woodhouse and I love Trollope, and I think that part of what writers like that, or even Mark Twain, have in common is they never forgot that they were entertaining people as much as they were observing things and absorbing, and creating their own masterpieces. That you have to do that. You have an obligation. You know, there's a World Ends Tomorrow, there's a desert island, there's like a doctor, a carpenter, a chef, and a writer. Guess who gets eaten?
Yeah, right.
You know?
We don't need your missives in the
sand
here.
They've been sitting around in their living room eating cheese doodles. They're all fattened up.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. And so you're a volunteer in so many ways. And so I feel like, therefore, that skeleton and that structure has to come on, because – people need it. People are going to sense that you're just sort of floundering around and mm-hmm. finding the story, mm-hmm. Unless you have some sort of structure. But at the same time, I feel like while I plotted it out a little bit, mm-hmm. It did need, in order to make it good, I felt I couldn't plot it out too tightly because then I couldn't surprise myself, which mm-hmm. sucks all the fun out of it.
Yeah,
that
right.
that novella I mentioned, mm-hmm. I tried to turn that into a full-length novel after graduation.
Mm-hmm.
It was the least fun thing. Hmm. Just to inject, every other. Just I was basically just making things longer that were perfectly
yeah.
fine
yep.
as they were, just to try to like give fat to it, and mm-hmm. it just. And I knew how it was going to end exactly. I mean, I really exactly knew how it was going to end.
Yeah,
I had the past
right.
like the last 40 pages didn't change.
Yeah.
So there's no.
Yeah.
Interest in story to me, and the characters couldn't breathe because
yeah.
I knew exactly where they were going.
I'm now, I mean, even just, you know, sitting with you is like, okay, you know, don't quit. Like,
don't.
I have two published books. I'm 3 years now into my novel.
This is great.
So Are you with the novel?
Can you talk about it?
I can when we're done.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. Got it.
But so I'm 3 years in. But when I remember beginning going, I think of it more in like a compass way as opposed to like an atlas or a map. And what I mean by that is I go, well, I know I'm going to this hemisphere.
Right.
But I don't necessarily know quite yet where within
yeah.
that hemisphere, but I know I'm going that direction. And so then I go. But for me, again, art like life, I've never had like a master plan. Like it's never been, at least not from the outset. And there's something for me about the writing process, particularly with long form, that because it's long form, I feel like I have to allow my writing to evolve with the person I'm evolving into as I write. And so if I get too rigid in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
then a year into it, I'm like, I'm not even capable of writing that anymore because
right.
I'm not that person anymore.
Right.
And so for me, there has to be kind of a congruence between content, the characters, the style, and the person I become along the way. And while I find a lot of liberty and a lot of autonomy and a lot of joy in that, there's definitely the moments when I definitely have a lot of trepidation of going, now what?
Right.
Like, what in the world am I supposed to do? Or, you know, I mean, some people would say it's good to write yourself into a corner
mm-hmm.
and, you know, whatever, fight your way out. But typically when I get in the corner, all I see is the corner. And so it scares me. And so sometimes I envy the people.
Like, I just want to curl up into a little ball.
Yeah. But I sometimes I know when I'm objective enough, I can see that it's – I mean, ultimately, someone just has to find the way they work best.
Right.
Like, however – whatever maximizes an individual's ability, that's how they should work.
Right.
And for me, this has proven to be the case, but I would be lying if I said at times I didn't look over my shoulder and kind of long for the, you know, strategery of
mm-hmm.
somebody else.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course you do, but it also depends on the kind of work you're writing. Some of it necessitates it and some of it doesn't. You know, like the kind
of
novel you're writing. And you can tell, you can read them. There are certain ones
yeah.
that you think are, you know, plotted within an inch of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that works and sometimes it feels like it chokes the life out of it.
Yeah. It can end up feeling a little bit like staged
yeah.
at that point. Where do you write at? Like, do you have
a
sanctum in your New York?
Yeah,
city
I write
domicile.
At home. It's not really a sanctum. It's called a living room. but it's, you know, I write at home or I skip town for a couple of weeks to do, like, jaunts of it.
Mm.
But mostly I, you know, yeah, I'm pretty good at writing at home. I mean, the only thing is that you have to contend with the uncertainty of, you know, construction and neighbors and things
mm-hmm.
like that could,
mm-hmm.
you know. Like, my apartment is freakily quiet. I mean, I'll hear like seagulls coming off the Hudson,
yeah.
you know, and I'm like, very early, but at like
yeah.
6 a.m. and
yeah.
I'll be like, what is this, Seattle? Great.
Yeah, right.
and then.
But is that sense of
which is
silence?
Great.
Is that pretty
I need
key
that.
In your process?
No, yeah, I don't do public writing. I can edit in public.
Okay.
Because it feels like I'm editing someone else's work, which is really what you should feel like when you're
mm-hmm.
editing anyway, because then
mm-hmm.
you'll be harder on it.
Yep.
But I don't do well with the group space thing, the like shared meals. No.
yeah.
Which is weird because I am actually a very social person, but I don't work well with others.
I have written, aside from you know, some work in college. I've written all of my published work on one laptop.
Wow. Good laptop.
It's a 2007 MacBook that my
– Heavy.
Yeah. It's like – I mean, it's like a big piece of lead.
Yeah.
But I got this laptop – so my mom died in 2007.
I'm sorry.
She bought this laptop 2 weeks before she died suddenly. And so she bought it, passed away, and never used it. And this was when, for me, I was kind of embarking on my professional writing journey. I just quit my previous job to do this like a couple months earlier. So I inherited this laptop. And I've had this, you know, maybe obvious, maybe not, but this sentimental and really kind of like, I don't know, just kinship with it. Because I always think of my mom. I mean, I think of like the way her fingers would move on things and stuff like that. But obviously that was 9 years ago, 2007. And so it has dealt with a lot of attrition and it's worn down. And like, you know, it hasn't been able to use the internet for almost like 3 years, but I haven't been able to let it go and I don't want to. But so this, just a few days ago, and every time I turn it off even, I'm terrified that the little, you know, gray apple in the middle of the screen that kind of sings that melodic note isn't going to be there, and it's going to be that question mark going, I'm sorry, I've you know.
Or bomb.
I've receded into technological heaven or whatever. But I turned it on Monday, just a couple days ago, and it didn't work anymore.
Sorry, you actually.
No, and I mean, it felt like.
Did you back up your stuff? I'm asking more.
I did.
Just less emotional,
I did.
Logistical question.
You're very concerned about that. No, I did.
Okay.
I have all that. But I turned it on, and I was expecting – I mean, I guess this goes back to what we were saying before even about mapping out and almost like projecting how we're going to respond or how other things are going to respond or how we're going to respond mm-hmm. throughout the course of our lives. And I think for years I've been anticipating that I would very much be like – you know, Tom Hanks in Castaway when Wilson the volleyball floats away.
Oh.
And that it would be devastation even though it's this inanimate object
right.
that he's losing, but it wasn't an inanimate object to him. That's what I was anticipating. And Sloan, it stopped working. And what actually was harder than being devastated by the fact that, you know, this kind of last vestige in terms of materially of my mom was now deceased. The real devastating part was that I wasn't devastated. It's that I felt nothing.
Mm.
And like I – it stopped working and I didn't care. And I just
– But dude, that doesn't mean – it sort of gave you the gift of, I mean, carrying you through to the point where you didn't care between
– Totally.
You know.
But I still
want to
care.
And when you say don't care, it just means that you – You're not in mourning for it.
Yes. And it
it's
means
not that you don't care.
And it doesn't it certainly doesn't mean I don't care about my mom.
Yeah, that would be a little
it certainly doesn't
dramatic.
Mean, it certainly doesn't mean that. But it just means I don't need to associate her through that laptop anymore.
Yeah.
It means that I have like fond, wonderful memories of her and you know, she was this, you know, incredible.
It's also probably
woman.
Not the only like talisman.
No.
Or object you have is
no.
not a laptop. It's really there
no.
are photos.
Of
there
course.
Are objects.
Of
there
course.
Are memories that you have. So, like, I mean, I think maybe if that was, I mean, if we're going to go with the Tom Hanks analogy, it's literally his only friend and his only possession on a desert island.
Right.
You have other things that are tethered to the same memory and the same person that don't have to be the laptop. I'm just glad you backed everything up.
I mean, yeah, the side of you is like, okay, Josh, great about your mom.
I know exactly what you mean, though. I know what you mean. I have a compass that I usually carry, an antique compass that I usually carry around
everywhere.
With me. Not everywhere, but I always carry it when I travel, always. And it was given to me by, I mean, you would think that I would hate it. It's so bizarre.
Hmm.
It was given to me by an old boyfriend. I mean, he's of normal age. But he's an age-appropriate
geriatric
person.
He's a centenarian. Yeah,
he's so old. That's how he got around. He never watched. He had the compass. But no, he's gonna be who really broke my heart at the time. It was awful. I mean, not he wasn't like you know. I gave her my heart. She gave me a pen. He gave me the compass when things were going well. But it's now I've had it for long enough. At first, it reminded me of him a lot, and then I've had it for long enough that it's become mine. And there's something. great about taking it back and feeling like, you know, if we're going to use the compass analogy that it begs for, it being a compass, that it will, you know, point me in the right direction. And I always have it with me when I travel, not because I think I'm going to use it, but it seems like a travel symbol, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also a really cool, beautiful little thing. And that's the other thing is I sort of step back and I'm like, this is a really neat thing.
Yeah.
I liked it when I got it. And it's more reminds me of the time period when I was very happy with this person. And then there have been other, you know, other people, other lives subsequently. But I always have it.
Wow.
Yeah. But it turned into something. And I would have thought that I would, you know, there are other things that still have the same association, you know, either good or bad or sad or whatever they are. But this one sort of morphed into, and it means something totally different to me now.
Well, and that's like, again, I mean, again, the parallel between that and writing, like part of the great, I mean, part of what's so great about carrying it around is that the meaning has grown to surprise you. You didn't necessarily project that meaning at the outset.
And I'm not, by the way, trying to equate getting broken up with a parent dying.
Yeah. No, we get it. We get it, Sloan. Thanks a ton.
I'm like, oh, you broke your leg? Because I got this paper cut the other day and it
was
really
brutal.
Stung. It was in that little thumb webbing. I just, I know.
Do you have any books that you carry around? Like, that you read over and over? You know, like the constant companions of
Interesting.
Your life?
Interesting. I've booked, not that I carry around. Mm. Like a leather-bound Bible or something.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I carry, you know, sometimes if I'm going away, there's certain – to write specifically, not just on vacation, but if I'm going away to work, there are certain books that I'll take because they remind me of – you know the old, like, Neutrogena ads?
Yeah.
Which were, like, really pathetic, actually, now that I think about them. Because they were like, don't make us your regular shampoo. You don't have to say you love me. Just pretend you do. Or just use us occasionally.
Yeah, right.
So you have, like, thousands of women across America with, like, half-empty bottles of Neutrogena because they're only using it occasionally. It's really sad. But anyway, but they're meant to be cleansers, right? Mm-hmm. They're meant to get all the gunk out. Mm-hmm. And this is and there are a couple – there are two books that I tend to – three, really, that I take with me, and they're two are more similar than the third one. But one is David Rykoff's Fraud. I love him. Wonderful writer. Very sadly died. Just, like, even still hard to say out loud. Seems so wrong. And, like, a made-up fact. I take that book around, especially if I'm writing nonfiction, just because you can get, and you know this, you get so in the weeds that you're like, what does one of these even look like?
Yeah,
I have no idea. And it's not like I'm trying to imitate him. I just don't even know what one looks like.
Yeah.
Another one is a collection of Dorothy Parker's work. It's just, like, also for the same reason. And then the other one is Dubliners by James Joyce. And that, because I have a weird attachment, I love the collection, I've read it many times, but I have an attachment to that copy. Like, I've had it forever. You can see it's all wiggly in the middle where I dropped it in a lake by accident
You
know? And I keep, like, other things in it. And, like, it's one of the few books I've ever had that I've underlined or taken notes in, which I normally consider blasphemous, but somehow. So those are the three. Do you take books with you, places you go?
Yes. Okay. I mean, not necessarily every place I go, like you said, but and I tend to not. When I'm in the midst of a writing project, I'll take, like, the same books typically over a 3 or 4 year period of time. And I mean, you articulated that well. They it's not so much that it becomes an attempt to conform to their voice, but it's just like a reminder that this is possible and that I should keep going. But one of the books that I've carried around for the last couple of years is a book by Cormac McCarthy called Sutri.
Oh, yeah.
Which he wrote a long
time. Very, but, B-side.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Very
deep-cut Cormac McCarthy.
Very deep-cut Cormac McCarthy. But the language is just like, I mean, you kind of, like, every page you're going, I didn't know half these words even existed. But I gravitate to that because, to me, it, you know, when I see those pages, I see someone who doesn't just love stories, but they love language. And so I carry that around, and then I tend to carry either some Bukowski or some T.S. Eliot around with me. And I find, you know, comforts in those things. I think I sometimes carry them just to remind myself that maybe I'm a writer too. And I don't know, I guess I find, like, a certain permission in that?
It's weird. Well, it can go either way. I mean, there's certain things I won't read because they – I mean, not won't read ever, but won't read while I'm trying to write because they remind me that I am not a writer.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, yep. Nabokov, get him the hell away
yeah,
from me.
Yeah, we are not doing the same thing.
No. I don't want to know that that's what this looks like.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know – but it's important to read that in between to want to do it to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I read people like, you know, Hemingway and Salinger. Like they talk about when you're setting out.
So you're
to
like
write,
not a big adjective person.
Me? It depends. I can go either way. I can get very adjectival unnecessarily. But you know, they talk about how when you set out to write something, you should seek the unattainable. Like you should seek your version of perfection.
Of course.
And so you're right that like the one half of that coin is it's inspiring. But the other half of it is then when you see what that brought out in them,
right?
It's like really daunting, and you go, right. "I think I might be a cartoonist, and you're Michelangelo."
But you also have the same. But that's the thing: there are great cartoonists, and there's great Michelangelo. So I mean, I feel like there's, but I actually feel like the cartoonist is okay. I get a little bit of a chip on my shoulder sometimes about the comedy thing, where, sort of it's very hard for humor writers are like no. Books that have funny moments will certainly win the National Book Award the same way that movies that have funny moments will win an Oscar.
Yep.
But an actual – like Diane Keaton is – I mean she was nominated once. She's never winning an Oscar. It's never going to happen.
Right.
It's just like there's an incredible – like
unless she's in a dramatic role.
No, but she won't – like even the – but she like – yes, unless she's in a dramatic role. But like her as a comedic actress, which is what she is. But of course there's huge moments of pathos and depth and there's all sorts of, you know real like raw emotion in her performances, but it doesn't matter because it's buried in the thing that people think is not acting. That must be easy, right?
Yeah.
So similarly, there's like I think that being the most amazing cartoonist wouldn't be so bad. So you should, I mean, as long as like you said, everyone's personal goal of perfection. As long as you're not striving for their goal of perfection,
right.
Do you know what I mean? I guess I'd want to write like Zadie Smith. I wouldn't mind. It would be wonderful. I adore her books. I adore her. But I just wouldn't. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's not my idea of what I most want to do with whatever is the outer limits of my imagination.
Well, and I mean, you seem to, I mean, you know, take it from someone who's now known you for like an hour. But you seem to be someone who is like, savors your voice in a good way, you know, and that you're able to like see the value and believe in the value of that. And I think that's like a really, really remarkable quality about someone that rather than thinking that they would be better served or somehow their readership would be better served if they were, you know, puppeting someone else's voice,
right?
You know, like,
well, there are chameleon people that are. Really, I mean, Eugenides is a chameleon person, T.C. Boyle, you know, I mean, even Zadie, that every novel is different. And, yeah, of course, I hope that I can do that. But for nonfiction, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. What do you daydream about? I want to give you a couple quick questions here. We're just about out of time. But I want to give you a couple quick questions to conclude. What do you daydream about?
Oh, my gosh. No one has ever asked me this. It's not that hard hitting, but it is. But it's true that no one's ever asked me.
Okay.
I feel like we're in the safety of this room.
I
can be honest.
Yep.
Usually, the daydreaming. As much as you don't like busy, I do like being busy. So there's not a huge amount of daydream. I know.
Sloan, you're insane. Like, oh my
probably
gosh.
True.
I'm stressed just hearing that
just
you like
hearing.
Being busy. I'm
perspiring I don't like being. I don't like being like so busy that I feel like I need. You know. That every minute I don't want to feel like the president. We're like, okay, seven minutes, we have a meeting, and then we're gonna go, and you know, you have 2 minutes for lunch.
Okay,
just even imitating it is upsetting. I don't want that.
Okay.
No, I'm saying that's bad.
We're gonna talk Socrates. Socrates says, "Beware the barrenness of a busy life."
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. That sounds unpleasant to me. I think balance is good.
Yes.
But
I'm sorry.
But I do. But if I do, like, in other words, if I am, the daydreaming usually happens during like. Walks or exercise or not in my apartment. Like, I don't sit – like, the idea of sitting around in my apartment daydreaming, like, any sort of errant thought I have. I mean, I'm sort of lucky and to be a bit cheesy about it is, like, maybe I do daydream and I just don't realize it because I'm getting paid to do it.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah,
I just feel like there's those, oh, what if this? What if this? And, oh, okay, imagine that. And, you know, falling down a rabbit hole of thought that usually is because I'm working on something. Mm-hmm. But genuine daydreams, I daydream about playing the guitar and being a figure skater.
Figure skating together?
Don't tell anyone.
Together?
Playing the guitar and figure
like,
skating
like
at the same
time. Like the Naked Cowboy in Times Square.
Oh, my gosh. It hadn't occurred to me. Usually it's like if I'm running, which happens very infrequently, but just walking really, really fast. and I have music on it. And if it's a really good song, I like imagine either being a dancer or a figure skater and dancing to
it. I'm just envisioning you doing a triple Lutz while strumming and playing Don't Stop Believing.
That's so cow to you.
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that would be amazing. Oh, that I really get detailed about it where I think about the song. And whenever I'm listening to it's probably not some classical composition, especially if it's, you know, if I'm using it to exercise. And I think I dream specifically, I can't believe I'm sharing, I've never told anyone this before, but I think about being like a sort of like a punk rock, like badass version of like Oksana Baiul or something, where like the Olympic Committee expects you to do something and all of a sudden you put on like Sia. Like, I don't know. Like, it's
they're,
just
they're expecting
they're
this
really
like highfalutin music.
Exactly.
And you
it's
go
not
a different
just
direction.
Like it's not just like oh yeah. like daydream. Like the guitar thing is more abstract. It's like that'd be cool. This is like this is I mean full on the costumes design, the whole thing. There
what
you go.
What breaks your heart?
Like, please let's get off this. I mean, right now.
Yeah.
Not to be, I mean, I don't know when this will air, but the, or air, the, when you're going to put it up, but people not voting breaks my heart. Little kids not being read to breaks my heart. And on a more personal level, I think feeling like you're like an imposter in your life, feeling like, and whatever it is, feeling like, wow, how have I gotten this far down X road, and it could be anything. It could be a relationship. It could be like a job you're doing. It could be like how did like I go from having this healthy friendship with somebody to suddenly all I do is like listen to her or we're like keeping score, whatever it is. Like that sort of devolving of something good makes me very sad.
Do you feel that way?
Right now, no. I don't have anything I feel that way about right now, but I've felt all of those examples in the past.
Yeah.
Or like wanting to be in love with someone you're not in love with. You know, all those things that can be said.
You are a remarkable person. You've got to you got to come back because I could just I could consume entire calendar months of your life.
It's
just,
so fun.
Just talking
You're
with
so
you.
Lovely. Thank you.
Sloane Crosley, The Clasp.
Yes.
How did you get this number? I was told there'd be cake. You got to read them. They're really, really remarkable. Her work is all over. Thank you so much for taking
thank
the time.
Thank you for having me.
You
are
so welcome.
Much fun.
Come
thank
back
you.
Again. Thank
okay.
you. Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. But please join me again next week.